Welcome on to a Sunday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast, the Olympics in the rearview mirror. The USA saved my heart from exploding by winning in fairly comfortable fashion against Serbia and still controlling the game against Spain, even though it wasn't necessarily a comfortable victory. We also got to talk about the bronze medal game, the semifinals, and we're going to go through, pick some of our all-tournament teams, biggest surprise teams, biggest disappointments, talk about some of the NBA prospects as well. That'll be part one. And then part two, we're going to get into another part of our best and worst contracts since the lockout series. Also want to remind you that we are sponsored today by the Ring Video Doorbell. Find out more about them at ring.com/capspace. You can get $50 off the Ring of Security Kit. ring.com/capspace. Also, the Naked 3D Fitness Tracker, the world's first home body scanner. naked.fit/capspace is how you find out more about them. Danny, are you surprised that it turned out so easily for the U.S. today?
Not really. I thought Serbia was definitely a preferable matchup for them compared to Australia, and that really manifested itself. I just thought that their personnel didn't fit very well, and while Jokic played well against the U.S. the first time, that's not enough to swing a gold medal game. And I was trying to think about it, and you know, there have been a lot of names for teams, and for me, this was the relief team because there was this stress about it, and that I was uncertain, even though I thought they were the prohibitive favorites going into this game. Just the fact that they had the capacity to play some terrible stretches, though that did get mitigated by changing the lineups around.
Yeah, relief team doesn't rhyme. I think we're going to have to come up with something a little bit better on that one. But I agree with you. They had that horrible stretch in the group stage, and then at least the defense came together pretty well. The Spain game was a little bit of a nail-biter, more, I think, offensively disappointing. They had to rely on great offensive rebounding, and we talked about how just like in the NBA, any team with Pau Gasol at center is going to struggle to defensive rebound, and then you put Mirotić next to him, and they're just as bad at defensive rebounding as their Bulls front line was this past season, and Spain really, with the athleticism deficit as well. And I think the biggest guy that they really missed in comparison to past efforts, when I thought they really pushed the U.S. more so than in this game, which it seemed like the U.S. controlled, was Juan Carlos Navarro, who's now 36. In the two previous gold medal games, he had really gone off and it proved very difficult for the U.S. to stop. And Spain did not just have that money knockdown shooter to really open things up in the middle.
Yeah, no team really had the combination of assets of players that you need to beat the U.S. unless you just have a game where they hit everything in the U.S. hits nothing like that. That's really the way to do it, like with Manu, somebody who can stymie it, but then a real rim protector. You know, there aren't that many teams in this tournament that had that. And just, or even like Croatia didn't really have a point guard. You know, they had other guys that can handle the offense. And so that I made a tweet towards the end of the game about how now it's time for some other countries to put it together. And, you know, some of that is opportunity. You have to have the right players born at the right time. But this U.S. team, while they came together at the end, they were fortunate that they had a lot more wiggle room than a lot of other teams do. But they had it, they used it, and they won.
Their communication got a lot better on their switches. They credited in the game before, or the day before playing Argentina, actually a full contact practice that they had on Tuesday, which had been their first since almost 3 weeks prior in Chicago. And whether it was that, whether it was switching to not having three terrible defensive players in the starting lineup, moving DJ into the starting lineup, he was fantastic against Spain, really. And we had talked about how the U.S. had blocked basically no shots in those last few games in the group stage. They really were much more active. Kevin Durant went from playing horrible defense to playing outstanding defense the last couple of games, actually getting through screens. He only got back cut from the corner once, which was a massive improvement for him. And then, of course, he was absolutely on fire, despite the fact that it seemed like the whole team couldn't dribble the ball. I don't know what it is about those balls. It's like they're almost, they seem like they're overinflated and they're slick, and they just kind of, guys dribble them, and it seems like it just bounces off the floor harder than they expect, and they'll lose it. But they got it together and shot the ball well, and ended up looking just about as good as some of the other teams did by the time it was all over.
And something that was an important factor early on in the game is that since Durant didn't sit in the entire first half, he helped support the offense of what was more the second unit guys, which had a lot of defenders. And that was one of the big problems early on in the group play, was that they kind of had offense and defense. And putting Durant with Paul George, Jimmy, and Kyle Lowry, I thought that worked really well. And also switching DeAndre and DeMarcus this really opened up Cousins to be more of an offensive force. And I thought he reacted well on that end. And something that we see with Cousins on the Kings is that oftentimes him succeeding on one end helps him on the other end. And while he wasn't great defensively, I thought he was substantially better in the last couple games than he was early on.
Yeah, Serbia finished 4 out of 24 on threes. Bogdan Bogdanovic, nightmare game, 2 out of 12, 0 of 7 on threes. Many of the, and 5 turnovers as well. Many of them pretty difficult looks early on that he wasn't able to hit, and then he got a couple of open ones later on, couldn't make them. Simonovic also was 1 of 4 on threes. Those were pretty much wide open, and Serbia just got completely throttled. They had a mere 43 points through three quarters, a 70 offensive rating before we got into garbage time. We did get a garbage time reference from Marv, which I certainly appreciated.
Yeah, there was a lot of garbage time, and it was amazing that there was a lot of garbage time before the guys at the bottom of the bench even got in, but that's the way it goes.
Jokic had 25 and 11 the first time these teams met. He got a lot of three-pointers off. He got to attack guys in the post on switches, and he was only 3 out of 5 in this game despite playing 24 minutes. Didn't even get close to sniffing an open three-pointer. The U.S. switched a lot more. They just had much more activity. Kyle Lowry was outstanding, getting loose balls, stunting off of guys. His activity, Paul George just...
Clay.
Paul George and Clay just forced Teodosic into pretty much a nightmare game. He was negative 29, worst on the Serbian team, and only had 3 assists. He was 4 of 11 from the field. Really just a fantastic defensive effort. Radulichko wasn't able to get going. He was in foul trouble early on. He was negative 24 in his 17 minutes. And once they brought Paul George in and Lowry, it really, I think at one point, was a 26-2 run for the U.S., and that pretty much put it away by the time halftime had rolled around.
And it's not all that surprising that those bench units, which had a lot of their good defenders, not only did well against second units, because of course they're a whole lot better than any other international team second units, but they have enough offense, especially when they're getting stops to do it. Paul George did pretty well in transition. Lowry, you know, all those guys can get enough there. It's a lot easier, I think, to get offense out of, you know, talented defenders in this context than it is to get defense out of talented scorers.
The U.S. continued amazing offensive rebounding as well. 20 offensive rebounds to 24 defensive rebounds for Serbia, and they actually had, I think, 11 offensive rebounds at the half to only 10 defensive rebounds for Serbia. Cousins was outstanding with 6 offensive rebounds, but guys like George, Jimmy Butler had 4 offensive rebounds. Just our wing guys were just out-hustling, out-athleting the other team, and that really, for any USA team, that sort of activity should be the number one advantage, both defense on the wings and just utilizing the athleticism advantage in the hustle categories. Those aren't things that you think of NBA superstars doing, but even when you're not an incredibly cohesive unit or your shot is off, that is a way that U.S. teams should always be able to win in international basketball, and this team finally put that together in the last two games.
And there are so few quality wings that not only can the U.S. get away with, you know, not only not bringing their best, but doing a lot of different things, but they can also take advantage of that in ways like putting Clay on Teodosic and having Kyrie somewhere else and not getting smoked by it, because no other team has that 1-3 that is good enough to force a team even like the U.S. that has a shaky defender to get out of it.
There's been a lot of talk about Carmelo being one of the best international players ever, and he has had a nice run with the USA. Didn't play much in 04, but then 06 he had that unbelievable game to save them against Italy. 07 Tournament of the Americas, he dunked all over some poor Argentine backup center whose name escapes me at the... Friedrich Kamerix, I believe is the guy's name. That's actually probably the best dunk of Carmelo's career. 08, he was excellent. He had the 37 in like 18 minutes against Nigeria in 2012. But I think other than... in that game against Italy, he was kind of running up the score against teams that weren't that great and was always a defensive liability. I would actually say now that Durant, with how well he played in 2010, the 30 in the gold medal game being the leading scorer in 2012, his performance in this tournament, he now, I think, is the greatest USA male basketball player of all time based on his performance in these tournaments, because he has been just unbelievable.
Yeah, and I mean, LeBron just didn't really have that kind of a resume, though, for Olympics being what they were and not playing this time. But Durant also, his game works when he cares on defense works so well with the international game, because like some of the best shooters, he can just nail from the international line. He just feels so super confident. Of course, he can still shoot NBA threes, and his combination of size and athleticism when he's engaged is just incredible in this setting, because it's an even crazier advantage than it was in, let's say, the Western Conference Finals, when I would say in many ways he was the defensive linchpin for Oklahoma City's success against the Warriors. And to see him do even moments of that internationally, it's just a whole nother level.
KD plus 38 in his 30 minutes. He played the entire first half. And then Paul George plus 37. DeMarcus Cousins plus 34 in only 17 minutes. Cousins had not had a good tournament, but he was outstanding today. This is the one game where I couldn't really carp too much.
Isn't that what happened in 2014 too?
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Anthony Davis got in foul trouble, and I was really worried the U.S. was down, and Cousins came in, and he scored like 8 points in a row, got the whole Serbian team in foul trouble, killed it on the offensive glass. He was actually great in that game, too.
Yeah, and the U.S. team just has so much talent, and yeah, it was frustrating overall to see Draymond not play that much and not play that well, honestly, when he was in, and he struggled at times even before that in the exhibitions. But the U.S. has enough to survive it, and I am going to be intrigued to see also with this 3-year gap, because it's a longer gap now between the present and the World Cup.
Yeah, the U.S. won't have to play in the Tournament of the Americas now, having won the Olympics.
So to see whether anybody can really step up, and to a way to kind of lead this into the next game was that while the outcome was certainly a disappointment for Australia, not only in the bronze medal game today, but in the semifinal before, there are some real signs that they can reach a level as an international team in, let's say, 3 years to be really exciting.
Yeah, I don't know. Mills will be too old then. Dele might even be a little bit older. He fell off as the tournament went on. He was probably MVP through the quarterfinals and then really did nothing in the last two games on offense. And Bogut, if he plays, he'll be too old to really do much. Baines isn't really that good. I think they're going to have to really hope, maybe even more than Dante Exum and Ben Simmons, that Thon Maker could become their starting center.
How old is Joe Ingles? Is he like 27?
Well, he might be. I think he was 27 when he came in. He's either like 28 or 29.
Okay, that's. I was thinking if he was like 26, 27, that he could be more relevant than, because I actually do like his game in this setting as kind of being your third or fourth offensive option, because he's a good passer.
Yeah, and I think they could maybe, and we don't know what Exum is going to be. I think he's not a great shooter. Simmons, not a great shooter. So I think it's going to look a lot different. And Simmons has had his beef with the Federation so far as well. We'll see whether he is able to get around that. But I think let's talk a little bit about this game. Obviously, Australia felt like they were robbed. They were up by one after an Aaron Baines hook shot after a great pass from David Anderson, who actually I thought had a wonderful tournament.
He did.
After really not playing all that well a lot in when he was more in his prime, I felt like, for Australia. He probably had his best tournament for Australia at age 36. It was pretty remarkable. Brock Modum gave him some great minutes. But they go up by one with 9 seconds left. Sergio Rodriguez drives. Mills was in front of him, basically tried to back off, and just got called for a miserable blocking foul. Rodriguez hit 2 free throws, and then Spain did a great job. There was a timeout to advance the ball. Spain was able to get Rubio and Claver in. Rubio did a great job switching on to Mills, denying him the ball, and then Claver got a deflection that basically put it out of range for any kind of a shot. And then the call before that, too, I thought Australia really had some beef. Baines got called for shoving Gasol in the back with 2 hands. The refs will internationally just call that immediately when you put 2 hands there, even if you're not shoving. So maybe it technically was a good call. But again, you know, in the bonus, gave up 2 free throws to Gasol to give up the lead there, too.
It's tough because, to me, I watched the replay a series of times. The call against Mills, you know, was a bad call. It should not have been made. It's one of those kind of outcome determinant. If you see a guy fall, you think it was caused by the defender. It was a bad call. No questions asked. And that losing in that way is always terrible. But something that I talk about with some frequency, and it is really no solace, and people say it makes me sound like a robot, is that when a game is that close, you are accepting a level of risk due to an officiating mistake. And part of me wishes that that weren't the truth, but it is. And you have to just accept that. I'm somebody who grew up watching baseball, and you see that in baseball all the time. NFL people even know what they can't figure out what a catch is. Like, this is a part of it. FIBA refs, I mean, they had struggles throughout this tournament with technical fouls and things like that. And so it is unfortunate to have it decided on that, but it's also decided by every other mistake throughout the rest of the game. Bogut, you know, getting called for his fifth foul in the third quarter pretty early on. And all of that stuff matters. You know, it's a 1-point game, and it's the last call.
On Bogut, by the way, let me break in here. Sure. I got a lot of tweets when he was playing well, when Australia was playing well. Golden State's really going to miss Bogut. And yeah, they miss him for the one game out of every five that he would play well. And the two games out of every five that he wouldn't just commit completely stupid fouls almost as an excuse to get out of the game. And you saw him do that in both of these last two games. I mean, just dumb fouls, fouling Mirotić on going for offensive rebounds that he had no chance on. He got stuck in the game when Coach Lamanis didn't realize that he had four fouls fast enough and didn't get Anderson to the table in time. And then there were four or five possessions back and forth. Bogut actually blocked two shots before that and then ended up kind of catching Ricky Rubio from behind, a guy who's not a good finisher, and fouling him and getting sent to the bench for the rest of the game. So Bogut can be useful on the one games that he plays well, but remember, he played well in zero road games in like the last 3 months of the season, including the playoffs. So it's an element that would be nice for them to have every once in a while, but it's not like he was giving them that much on a consistent basis.
He's a different kind of useful player in that sense, and he's so talented defensively, and when you see him at his best, you wonder how it happens so infrequently now. But then, you know, it takes a lot physically to get him going. And so I want to go back a little bit, and the final play of the game was a couple of really remarkable things. So Australia, the intent of the play, the primary action, was a pretty cool thing. Like, they were going to do a handoff, and had the handoff been executed successfully, it needed two things. It needed the handoff, and then it needed the help defender to fall asleep at the switch. Fortunately for Australia, the help defender was Rudy Fernandez. That part of it was actually already done. But Ricky Rubio made a gigantic defensive possession, got onto Mills, prevented that, and there was no secondary option really on the play. Like, that was what they were going to do. And in a 5-second circumstance, you don't even enough time to really counter in any way, and that's why it ended up basically being a failure, never getting another shot.
Yeah, they inbounded it to Anderson, and I would have at least tried to get someone there who could have made a play off the dribble, you know, maybe make that Ingles instead, to where if the DHO was taken away, you could have tried to drive to get something. But, you know, it's tough in that situation, and Spain defended it extremely well. I felt like Patty Mills was unbelievable. He was getting whatever he wanted in pick and roll against Gasol. But when you score 31 points on 18 shooting possessions, your defense can be about as bad as anyone, and you're still going to be a valuable player. And Gasol just continues to be an incredibly efficient FIBA player. Like, what he did in this tournament at age 36, even with his defensive and rebounding limitations, to score the way he did was just a remarkable performance once again from him.
Yeah, I mean, you have to consider him, and we'll get into this a little later, for in the MVP standpoint, just because what would Spain have been without him? I mean, he was huge. Even though they disappointed at various levels in it, he was big in the group stages, and yeah, they did end up losing to the US, but I thought he played reasonably well in that game as well.
Yeah, they did kill Lithuania with him only scoring 4 or 5 points, but he was struggling with a calf issue at that point. He gamely played through that as well. I think that for Spain, though, you know, they're not at the level we talked about, that they weren't able to get anything out of Navarro, who's also 36 and don't really have that other shooter. Alex Abrines didn't play at all. I don't think that he's kind of at that level. Rudy Fernandez, another guy who's not what he was offensively now at age 31. Felipe Reyes used to provide some toughness, and he really struggled to finish at the rim. He was at age 36. So they're going to need a new generation to come in. I'm not sure that Willy Hernan Gomez is going to be the answer at center. I think Juan Hernan Gomez is someone who can really help them eventually to get some more shooting as kind of a backup for Mirotić, someone who's athletic, can get on the glass, But, you know, I'm not sure who the center is going to be on this team that's going to be good enough defensively to really make this team a threat to the USA in the future. I would say that Canada is probably looking like the biggest threat to me in 2020, but they've really always struggled to get all of their guys together. And that could again be the case of, although at least, you know, Jamal Murray, Tristan Thompson, and Corey Joseph all seem to really like playing. And so that at least I think could be the core of a very good team. We'll see who else comes along for them.
Something else, you alluded to it, but I think is a more important note to make with Spain long term is just their lack of wings.
That's the problem with every international team, basically, compared to the U.S.
Except for France when Batum plays well, which is not this year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was not good. Can you tell me how Australia only scored 5 points in the first quarter against her? I mean, that was just the most shocking result to me, that egg that they laid. Because I agree. I mean, they'd been so good throughout the tournament. And then Serbia, which they had some moments defensively. We talked about it in the last program against Croatia, how well Markovic played. But I don't think of them as some defensive juggernaut, and they just shut down the Australians.
There were a couple different things. Australia's offense stagnated more than it usually did. They were settling for stuff. They did get a couple of clean looks that didn't go in. And another huge aspect of that is that they only got one offensive rebound in the entire quarter, despite missing a bunch of shots, and that was a team rebound. So they didn't actually corral an offensive rebound in that entire quarter. And all of those things, you know, they're not getting system buckets, and Serbia was scoring enough that Australia wasn't getting much in transition, which is actually something that helped sustain them for moments in the Spain game. And so it was kind of all of those little bad things. But the biggest difference was just that their activity offensively did seem a little bit lower, a little bit more lackluster. And it wasn't generating anything, which is super weird, not for all the other reasons you mentioned, but also because Serbia doesn't really have a rim protector. And so it wasn't like there's a reason to be intimidated, or you just, like, to me, you drive with impunity. And if you get fouled, you get fouled. They have pretty solid free throw shooters as well. So just do that. And it felt like they were like, the driving lanes weren't necessarily there. They were taking the shots and they weren't going in.
Yeah. Serbia had a lot of success switching. Fran Fraschilla, I think it was Doug Collins alluded to that on the broadcast today. And I think for a lot of these teams, just they don't have stars who can just go one-on-one and beat switches. I think switching can be a very, very effective strategy against some of these teams, as long as you don't have any really bad weak links. And I mean, for Serbia, even they don't have anyone who's real small, at least. Like Teodosic is not really a great defensive player, but they're able to switch enough that it wasn't too much of an issue. And some of the off-ball stuff, like with Patty Mills especially, didn't work. Dellavedova was not able to get free.
Thing I want to mention, because it factored into both Australia games, Aaron Baines not being able to finish well in the interior was a big problem in both stretches. And I think that's something he was a player that proved his usefulness, let's say, but he needs to be limited in that way, because his inability to score around the basket is really deflating, because that also generally creates good opportunities for the other team.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is the same problem in the NBA. He shot only 44%, which as a big center is getting the type of opportunities that he was in this offense is not very good. Also, 4 out of 31 three-point shooting for Australia. Mills, for example, is 1 out of 9. He was on fire the rest of the tournament. Ryan Brokhoff, who until the last game had a really miserable tournament, was 1 out of 6. He's an excellent shooter in Europe. Ingles was 0 for 4. I mean, those guys, getting up 31 three-point shots is pretty good. Like, they took 35 twos and 31 threes in the game and just could not make anything. And then Teodosic was unbelievable in that game with 22 points and 5 assists. He was really the guy who pushed them offensively, making some ridiculous bank shots as well. And Markovic as well was 5 out of 5 from the field and scored 14 points, which was a pretty fantastic performance. And he's really a very solid defender. I was quite impressed with his defense in this tournament.
Yeah, I would say that Serbia was kind of lackluster for me in the earlier rounds, but I thought that the Australia game, and even before the doors got blown off them in the U.S. game, I thought that I saw a little bit more of how they can be relevant long term, even post Teodosic, though I do worry about their offense.
Who is your biggest surprise team of the tournament.
Can it be a negative surprise? Because it's France to me.
The next one's going to be most disappointing team. So surprise, I think of as positive.
Okay, positive surprise. I mean, Australia from start to almost finish was way better than I thought they would be. Their offense was active. Their defense was better. And they were getting performances. I mean, even Brock Modem today, like, they were getting some spots from guys that I just didn't think had that in them. And that's wonderful. And they have stars. You know, they have guys who are very good international players, but they were getting a more balanced contribution, which was exciting.
Yeah, they came by far the closest to beating the U.S., leading them by 5 at halftime. I mean, even the Serbia game, the U.S. was up by 10 most of the game, and then Serbia kind of came back. Same thing with France, although that was the French B team for a lot of that game. But yeah, I thought that result that Australia had, and even the Spain game too, they definitely pushed the U.S. the hardest, in my opinion, because that was a game in which the U.S. actually was hitting their three-pointers too, and Australia was still just killing them, getting backdoor after backdoor, making them look really bad defensively. And then some of the blowouts that they had, what they did to Lithuania was just a complete destruction. And it was really a shame that they were not able to make that second Serbia game competitive. They blew out France as well. That was early on. And so I think a lot of people in Australia were really excited about this team. And I thought they definitely played the best style, and not a team that I thought was necessarily going to be in the medal conversation, and they certainly got there, and you could argue deserved to win the bronze.
Yeah, and they were, I would say, pretty clearly the second most impressive team in group play. I mean, and you could even say I thought they looked better at 4-1 than the U.S. did at 5-0.
Most disappointing team for you?
France, easy. I mean, so I like to think about the kind of the big boxes international play. Of course, teams very rarely have all of them, but it's like, you know, a point guard who can run the show, rim protection, and kind of a go-to scorer. France is a team that has those. They have all those guys. They also have Boris Diaw, who's a wonderful international player, even as he's getting older. And they played poorly for most of the tournament.
Yeah, that complete non-compete against Spain in the quarterfinal in a game that we thought was going to be a classic, like their last two matchups had been, very, very disappointing. And I don't know, I think actually Diaw might be pretty close to done, even internationally. I think that having him out there kind of hurt them, and that, you know, we've talked ad nauseum about how their refusal to go small and how bad their offense is at times, given the talent that they have. I mean, also you can throw the USA's performance in the group stages in there too. I mean, it's really the worst defense I recall seeing from an American team since, you know, 2006 against Greece in some of those games. It was really, really bad. And I think a lot of it was lack of effort. A lot of it was bad coaching, bad lineups. And kudos to them for getting it together and actually finally fulfilling their defensive potential over the last three games. Even though I thought actually that Spain did miss a lot of wide open threes, and had it better three-point shooting and better defensive rebounding, could have made that a really close game, but that didn't happen for Spain.
Yeah, I'd say that's the number two, but for me, France is number one by a pretty significant margin.
Biggest surprise player?
For a long time, I really liked David Anderson. I thought he was an intriguing player. I like big guys who can shoot. It's not a surprise for those of you who listen to this or followed my writing. He was a guy that I kind of had on my radar for a while, and then a couple of years ago, he went off it, and I just never really stopped really thinking about it. And then to see him play, as you said, and I would agree with you, the best international tournament I've seen him play at age 36 was awesome.
He shot 54% from the field, mostly on long twos, but he was great in that Spain game. Once Bogut fouled out, shot it extremely well against the U.S. Not something that necessarily even was sustainable for him, but just I thought he was completely done, and to see him come through and play well was good for him. I thought on the negative side that Krunoslav Simon from Croatia was really bad. He shot 22% on threes, 33% for the tournament. Usually a pretty good shooter. He was turning the ball over left and right as well. He had like two or three passes a game where he'd just jump in the air on a pick and roll and just throw it away. Really disappointing for a Croatian team that really needed some shooting. And I think were he playing at his best, they could have rolled with him at the point and then had Hazonia and Saric and Bogdanovic all in, you know, with someone like Planinic at center, and that could have been a really good lineup for them, but Simon just was not able to really come through. How about another
Wait, can I mention one more point?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Facundo Campazzo in the Brazil game, like, I want a single. He was solid throughout the rest of it. He did a fine job, but in that game, he was sublime, and that he was such a big part in that shocking comeback and win was really surprising to me, because I just never think of him as being a part of that, you know, that group. He's outside of the golden generation in terms of age, but he's not super young. And he was awesome. He was spectacular in that game. Like, he was everywhere he needed to be, making shots, making passes. And I didn't love him the rest of the tournament, but in that game, he was a star.
Yeah, Raul Neto may not be able to dribble past half court for like the first half of the NBA season due to nightmares from Campazzo's ball pressure. He was great in that respect too, played a ton of minutes. And then Patty Mills would be my other positive surprise player. Just, yeah, granted, a solid NBA player for sure, but what he was able to do coming off screens, handling the ball in pick and roll, getting to the rim, he was the best cutter in the tournament. I mean, his sprinting hard off the ball, what he was able to do, either leveraging his shooting ability to go back door or faking backdoor and popping out for three. I just really enjoyed what he did off the ball. It was, and then he shot the ball really well, other than in that Serbia game. Just a guy who, if you were the opposition, you were cringing anytime he got an open shot, and he got a ton of them. He was able to really just get open for a ton of three-pointers. He shot 9 threes a game, and he only shot 34% because he had that one bad game where he's 1-9. But outside of that game, he was a huge threat, and still was able to get to the basket enough to keep the defense honest as well.
Yeah, he was looking like the best Spurs point guard out there.
Any other disappointing players? Batum and
Nikola
Valanciunas.
Batum. I mean,
oh man.
So Batum is a player that I was openly skeptical of his ability to kind of be the guy. And then he took on a much larger offensive responsibility in Charlotte and did a good job. And he deserves an immense amount of credit for that.
And he's had awesome games for France in the past. He had that game against Serbia in the 2014 World Cup when he dropped like 35 points, had a ton of clutch shots. And that one, they ended up losing that semifinal. You know, people were like, oh, this is Gasol's way better than him. This isn't the NBA. And like, well, Batum has had some great moments in FIBA. But the thing is that I think this happened to him in Portland too. I don't think that he is naturally that assertive of a player. And so if you have other guys who are going to dominate the ball, and that was Dia and Parker in this case, he's just going to sort of hang out by the perimeter and not really do that much. And I think they need to make more of an effort to get him the ball. He averaged 7 points for the tournament and only took average 5.5 shot attempts and only 22.6 minutes too. He scored the same amount of points per game as Brock Bodum, who did it in nine minutes per game.
And while he wasn't as frustrating, I guess, as Batum, Valanciunas just being such a non-factor was concerning, because Lithuania was pretty well situated to have him. He didn't have to be the alpha and the omega for that team. They did well, but he didn't have to, you know, fall from the moment the way that he did. And seeing him get so stripped so frequently and lose the ball in the post, I mean, as we talked about when we did the last one, you know, it's not like that reforms how I think of him as a player, considering the amount of sample that we have from the rest of him. And I really do enjoy watching the Raptors, but it was concerning.
6.7 points a game, 39% shooting from the field, and less than 2 free throw attempts a game as well, somehow.
Do you have a number for him on turnovers? It seems like
that is not on the FIBA page that I'm looking at, but I'm sure it was quite a few. I think they're not really the greatest at tracking individual turnovers either. I mean, there are a lot of plays where you just would get it inside and then just get blocked or kind of lose it or fumble the pass, and you know, I don't know who you're going to put that on.
Come on,
necessarily.
Come on, Sport View Olympics.
Rudy Gobert, I would also put in that category as well. I thought that his offense still has not come along, and he just missed a lot of shots inside, especially early in the Spain game when he basically got like 6 attempts in the first quarter or so and either just lost it or missed it, just right in the lane, pretty much point blank range. How about the best and worst coaching jobs?
It's the same 2 teams it feels like we've been using for all this.
Yeah, I guess that's right, huh?
It is, but I'll talk a little bit about Collet. I guess that's the place to start. France has a lot of problems in terms of like underperforming relative to their talent, but I think a significant portion of that is coaching. And I mean, I don't know if he's exactly to blame for the whole Fournier thing as well, but it's from what I've heard, it seems like it's at least a part of the equation. But just making sure, you know, we talked about just about Nicolas Batum, making sure that he's engaged. He is your best player. You need him to be there, even if that's force feeding him in moments, just to get him into that mode. Do the best you can. Understand, like, Rudy Gobert has weaknesses in his game, and I love the guy, especially international play. I think sometimes it's worse, except for knocking the ball off the rim. And France, especially in this tournament, just didn't do that. And I understand part of it is the political stuff about how, you know, I'm sure Tony Parker, like, not starting or minimizing his role would have been complicated. But at a certain point, if you're sacrificing, you know, the possibility of a medal to keep a guy happy in his probably his last Olympics, you maybe you dance with around it a little bit differently.
Yeah, underutilizing Dekolo, underutilizing Batum, playing all of their terrible fours instead of just playing Batum at the four as a way to space the floor more, keep Batum happier.
The Laverne-Diaw front court combination, which is just a turnstile.
Yeah, it was pretty. Yeah, playing Diaw too much was a bigger problem than playing Parker too much. But yeah, they really just did not. And putting the ball in the hands of Dekolo, I think he was by far their best guard. I think, and then best coach Andre Lemonis probably. I would say also Coach K in the preliminary rounds, I would put up there too as for
underperforming relative to talent. Sure.
Yeah, and just some of the issues that we talked about in that podcast. But, you know, at least he fixed them to some extent. I mean, and as we talked about in that podcast too, the biggest problem was just the individual players doing a better job at executing, playing with force, hustling. You know, there was a small lineup change. You know, they took DeRozan out of the rotation, didn't really play Green, but then started DJ instead of Cousins. And I think that really helped a lot. And they're able to, when the U.S. really killed teams, of course, was when they were able to go to that bench unit that was so good on defense. But Lemonis, we talked about how awesome the Australian system was. Their off-ball movement was great. They got a ton of threes. The defense was solid. They did some good switching at times as well. So I thought he was he did a great job. Christian Pelletier was all over that one beforehand about how beautiful the Australian system would be under him. And it turned out that was the case. We'll talk about our all-tournament teams in a second. But first, a message from the Naked 3D Fitness Tracker, the world's first home body scanner. This is just a cool, revolutionary product. If you go and get your body fat tested, it costs a ton of money, takes a ton of time, and it's not even really particularly accurate. Now, the Naked 3D Fitness Tracker will not only allow you to test your body fat easily and quickly at home, but it also gives you a heat map on your body, measures every aspect of your body by creating a 3D scan of your body. You step onto a scale, it rotates you around in about 20 seconds, scanners embedded in a mirror, scan your body, send an image of it to your smartphone, and you get your body fat. You can measure any part of your body, and you can see where you are gaining muscle and losing fat. That kind of progress that you can see early on in a fitness regimen helps you get results early on, before you would see them looking in the mirror, before the scale would show it. This revolutionary product is going to be going on sale for $1,000 in the spring of 2017, but you can reserve yours now at a price of $699, and you'll have to put down $95 at this point. It wouldn't be a Dunked On ad, of course, if you couldn't get a discount for being a listener. You can do that by going to naked.fit/capspace. Easy to remember, we talk about capspace all the time in the program. You can get that $50 discount on what's really a revolutionary product for your health, something that hopefully you'll own for years and years. I bought one before I even had them as a sponsor on the show. I sought them out because I wanted them to be a sponsor. I really believe in the product. It's a really cool thing. You go check it out at that naked.fit/capspace URL, and I think you'll be convinced as well. All tournament team.
So the first team actually for me was pretty easy, and I think we'll be in pretty close agreement. And I'm not doing it by positions. Did you do yours by positions?
I ended up getting to rough positions.
Yeah. Okay, because my second team is basically all point guards, but that's okay.
Yeah, I think I had the same thing with my second team too, and then I decided to mix in one more big.
Okay, so I think I'll go. So the two people that I think are the most seriously considered for MVP, if you were to give one of the whole Olympics, be Kevin Durant and Pau Gasol. So they're one and two. And then after that, it gets complicated because a lot of the players did well in certain games, didn't do well in others. I would say Patty Mills is definitely in that group. Paul George is definitely in that group. So for me, those are
Paul George definitely in that group? I mean,
to me, he is.
Yeah, I mean, to me too. I thought he was the best defensive player on the U.S. I thought he changed the game whenever he came in, partially because of who he was replacing, Carmelo. But he just, especially what he did to Teodosic.
In the Spain game, remember in the Spain game, it completely turned when Melo got that second quick foul and George came in, and that was really what swung that game. And I think that really resonated with me. He played well when he was in there, and the U.S. team didn't need as much in terms of scoring. They needed defense, and he brought that.
Yeah, he was, I thought, the most impactful defensive player in the whole tournament. And so despite the fact he didn't score a ton, and if he had played more, he would have scored more too. Yeah, I felt, and especially with the U.S. winning the tournament, and without anyone else who really, I mean the next best player probably would have been like DeColo on the second team. And I think just George is so much better of a player than he is. I felt quite comfortable putting him on there too. And then, so who's your last guy, Bojan?
Yeah, I ended up with him. I thought about a bunch of different, basically when I tell my second team, I thought about basically all those guys over him, but he did a really nice job for them. And I think at a certain point, that's enough. It gets hard to balance a lot of it. And also, I think he was more consistent, you know, in terms of a couple of solid games, as opposed to some of the players that are on my second team were more memorable single game guys.
Yeah, he led the tournament in scoring by 4 points a game and was extremely efficient, shooting 50% from the field, 45% on threes, and then he also got to the foul line for 9 attempts a game. So he was really, really efficient. Teams had a ton of trouble stopping him. His post game, he was just jacking up threes that were going in, getting out in transition, getting to the bucket and finishing. It was really just a wonderful tournament for him. And Croatia, while they did lose to Serbia, finished in first place in Group B. And I think, especially when you score that well, I think he absolutely deserved to be in there.
So you want to do your second team first?
Facundo Campazzo.
Okay.
Maybe it's Campazzo. I don't know.
I always say, I say Campazzo, but I'm not sure.
Nando DeColo. And those are the only two that I felt absolutely had to be on there. And did you have those two as well?
I had those two, and I had two others that I thought were kind of mandatory. Teodosic. And the other one for me is DeAndre Jordan, because he wasn't, you know, perfect. And of course, he was coming off the bench early on, but I thought he was incredibly impactful defensively and also was on the offensive glass. I thought he did a nice job and was, I think he was the best big man in the tournament other than Powell.
Yeah, I guess you would have to say Teodosic would be in there. Although if you look at his stats overall, and this is something that there's been talk of him coming to the NBA. I think he would be a 29-year-old when his contract with CSKA expires next summer. I don't know that he, over the course of an NBA season, is necessarily going to be able to score efficiently. He can make some open threes at times, but he doesn't really have the quickness to get separation. He relies a lot on coming off the screen and kind of pulling up for tough two-point jumpers. Not going to get all the way to the rim that much. He is a brilliant passer. I think he can average a lot of assists, but then you throw in his defense, and I'm not sure, we'll see whether he's a starting level player in the NBA or not. I think you're going to have some pretty good defenders around him. A team that really needs some playmaking and has some good defenders maybe could use him. He ended up just, well, it seemed like he had a brilliant tournament. He only shot 37% from the field and 32% from three during the tournament. So it really was not, and he wasn't making up for it on the defensive end either. He definitely was a huge threat and looked great in that game against the U.S., looked great in that game against Australia, but wasn't as good at other times. I did end up including him just because I felt like he was a big part of the story of this tournament. But if you really look at what he did over the entire course of the tournament, wasn't quite as impressive as you would have thought. And then I also had DeAndre as well, and then Andres Nocioni, if only because of that unbelievable game that he had against Brazil and for Argentina, just to make it even into the second round, I thought was a good accomplishment considering where they were at. Manu did not quite have the final tournament that I think he would have hoped he would.
Yeah, Nocioni is hard because it was really that one game. Calientes, is that how you say it?
Yeah, Montes Calientes. I thought about him too.
I liked what he did overall for Lithuania, just to be more of a consistent positive, because that Lithuania was a strange team in terms of having success in the early part, you know, those first three games, but they didn't really have like one guy in that sense.
You know, it's interesting, Durant played the whole first half today, And I tweeted that I thought Coach K was teaching international teams a lesson on how many minutes to play your guys in an important game like this. It's a 40-minute game, and there are plenty of stoppages due to all the fouls. If your guy's not in foul trouble, just play him. You know, and European coaches, I think just in part because there isn't as much of a difference between the stars and the reserves on a lot of these deeper European teams who don't have NBA superstars who are at the end of that long-tailed distribution of talent. You know, you just have more guys who are kind of in the middle who are closer to one another. But nonetheless, I think that a lot of teams in Europe could benefit from just playing their best players more often, especially when you consider that they play far less often than NBA players have to. And when you look at some of the stats in this tournament, yeah, it's a 40-minute game, but there are only three guys in this tournament who average 20 a game, you know, and only six guys who average more than 15.8 points a game.
Well, and was it the first half of the U.S. game that was 40 possessions?
Yeah, the U.S. usually plays at about 40 possessions. The other teams usually play at between like 35 and 37 per half.
So that's more workable as well.
So, and I think actually it was, and it probably looking at Calniente's stats, he probably should have given him a little bit more credit maybe than Nocioni, because Calniente shot 60% from the field, which was pretty good, and averaging 18 points a game is really the only point guard on that Lithuanian team. But yeah, I think they just, you know, Campazzo only played 28 minutes a game, and I guess it's a tournament too, but you have a day off in between all these games.
Yeah, they never played back to back.
Yeah, and especially when you're getting into the medal rounds too. There were not a lot of, I've actually kind of struggled to fill out the second team basically. I did not struggle, however, to find the MVP. That was Kevin Durant. Very easy, full stop for me.
It would have been harder after just the group play, because I thought Durant was incredibly uninspired during that, but his play during the knockout stages gives it to him, because he was huge offensively, helped carry the load, and was more impactful in a positive way defensively than Pau Gasol, who I thought was the other real candidate.
Yeah, and Gasol's defense and rebounding were big time negatives for the Spain team in both of the medal round games. And Durant sure had a nice tournament, considering that he really struggled with that molten ball, that he was seemingly mishandling it on half of the possessions when he would try to dribble it. But fortunately, he was able to just pull up from so deep that it didn't matter a lot of the time.
Yeah, and he was able to shoot. I mean, I thought he was so much more dangerous in catch shoot, maybe because of that. But he's just like, he had those moments offensively where they just give him the ball and realize, oh yeah, if I take one dribble, I can just get past this guy and dunk on him. Like that happened a couple times in the Serbia game, and just kind of the embracing of being that guy. He can be that guy in international play any second he wants, because none of these teams have players who can defend him.
One thing I did notice, this is a little disjointed, but LeBron James really helps to paper over a lot of Kyrie Irving's bad tendencies by handling the ball himself. Kyrie, every time after a make, he would cross half court with 17 on the shot clock. There were so many possessions when he brought it up when they wouldn't get their first pass until there was under 10 on the shot clock. And the problem with him is he just doesn't give the ball up. He never gives it up without having tried to make a move, and he never makes a quick move. He's always going to wait, and he's an incredible offensive player to try and blow by guys. But if he would just draw the defense to him and then kick, like you never really see him drive and kick. Like he had a couple of times where he pushed the ball. He had one where he set up Clay for a corner three. That was great, but he just always seems to be trying to get his own shot first, and he never just seems to make a pass unless he feels like he's created something first. He won't just run the offense and swing it to somebody early on in the possession. And so many times when you do that with these great players, even if you can just get the defense slightly leaning and then reverse the ball, those guys can get an opening and explode to the cup. And I felt like it was really frustrating watching him be the point guard of a team that I was rooting for, because he just did not move the ball, and I thought really struggled defensively as well. It ended up not really mattering, and they were able to paper over some of his defense's weaknesses once they got DeAndre in there. Doug Collins did a great job of talking about how DeAndre is a good pick and roll defensive center, worked with Kyrie, and then Paul George and Lowry worked really well with a bad defensive pick and roll center in Cousins.
I feel like I need a basketball therapist to deal with my opinions on Kyrie, because he is so phenomenally talented, and I feel like I can't separate that sometimes from the parts of it. Like, I think he has the best handle in the NBA personally, and there are people who disagree, and that's fine. But and when he engages in the good parts of his offensive game, even as an on-ball guy, I think he's phenomenal off-ball. I think he's better off-ball than on-ball. He can do it, but he doesn't really tap into that very often. And it's the same thing now with his defense. He had that unbelievable game one of the 2015 finals, and then he had some really nice stretches in the 2016 finals as well, including in their 3-1 comeback. But it doesn't happen consistently enough. And it's not a situation where I think he's worried about being hurt or anything like that. It's just the way he runs. And
and now it's just going to be the worst part of it is like now you can't criticize the guy because he hit, you know, he had a wonderful last three games of the finals and was absolutely unstoppable in those games. One on one.
His game five was one of the most impressive things I've seen covering the NBA.
Yeah. I think he's like Jamal Crawford on steroids in the sense that, and Kobe was like this too, that I think players have, and a lot of people in the public have this incredible respect for guys that you just can't stop no matter what you do, you know, who can just get open for really tough shots and make them at times. And Kyrie can be very efficient as well. He's a great three-point shooter. You know, all that, I mean, is incredibly valuable. He's a good player. He's got such a high upside at times. But that's what makes his difficulties functioning in the team concept a little bit more galling, especially on a completely loaded team like this. Whereas with the Cavs, you know, it's him and LeBron are really the only guys who are going to be creating off the dribble. So that sort of pound the ball game is a little bit less annoying.
It also compounds when you have a coach that it seems like really wants the ball in the hands of the point guard, you know, who embraces that kind of idea. Of course, it's also not having LeBron, because that's another thing internationally that LeBron can help with, is just having different types of point guards with him. And usually that's a position that is flesh in Team USA, but just this year, by happenstance and injury, that didn't end up occurring. And so with Kyrie, as I said, I think he's better off ball than on ball. And so basically saying, oh, it's going to go through him, then that means all those idiosyncrasies are going to take center stage.
Yeah, guess what, guys? It's possible that he had an unbelievable finals and hit the game-winning shot in the finals and had one of the best finals games of all time. And yeah, still has these flaws as a player that he needs to work on.
Like, absolutely.
It's possible that both of those things could be true. You don't automatically get Teflon for the rest of your career because you had three good games in the finals. As great as those games were, I don't mean to diminish those in the slightest, because they were awesome and Golden State could not deal with them. And that's a big part of why they won the series. Let's talk a little bit about how the NBA prospects and players in the tournament did. Let's start with Dario Saric. Your impressions with him? He was coming over to the Sixers this year.
I think he's more of a support player in the NBA level than a real like star, but he has such a kind of, it's not an all-around game, I think that's overstating a little bit, but he can do enough of everything to make him really interesting. His shot, he seemed more comfortable with it in this tournament than I usually see with it. He really likes backing guys down, which makes me question my thought that he was going to be a four, because that's going to be a really hard position for him in that way. But I feel
I think he actually can do that against a lot of these combo fours and be successful. He's 6'10", he's tough.
He's strong. He's strong for his size. Like for his
build. I mean, you saw like what he did. I mean, Kuzminskas is a little bit light in the rear, but you know, you saw what he did to guys like him who essentially are going to be a combo forward type. You know, I think you have to put a guy on him who's pretty strong. And then, I mean, he's going to be, if he plays with Simmons, he's probably going to be guarded by threes more of the time. One of those two guys will be, and both of those guys are really strong. And
he can work switches in that way too, which is great.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. I agree with you that his shot looked like it was coming along. He did have that one unbelievable block to seal that game in the preliminaries against Gasol. But I think overall, his lateral quickness leaves a lot to be desired. I don't see him, especially trying to close out to shooters at the three-point line, I think is going to be an issue for him. He fouls a lot. So I don't see him. I mean, I think he and Simmons together is going to be a pretty rough defensive front court. I don't think he's going to start. They'll probably start Gerald Henderson alongside Simmons. But, you know, I think he could be a solid offensive player in the NBA. The question with a lot of these guys who can pass like him and come over from Europe, he's bigger than a lot of those guys, is, all right, if you're not putting the ball in his hands, what are you doing? You need, hopefully they can craft a system that distributes the ball enough that he can make use of his talents and isn't just going to be spotting up somewhere. I also like the fact that he really likes to duck in hard at times. I think that is just an underutilized tactic. And again, with his toughness, I think he can really surprise some NBA wings with those sorts of plays.
Yeah, there's a lot to like, but he'll have to be used well. And I think that's true of a lot of players with unusual skill sets.
Jokic had that one wonderful game against the U.S. I think that his versatility on offense, he's going to be a wonderful offensive player, if not a guy where you put the ball in his hands to just go get you a bucket. Someone who can post up on switches. He doesn't do as well posting up on guys who are his size, but that's okay. You don't need to necessarily do that. His three-point shooting, his passing, he may be in a very short time the best passing center in the NBA. He might already be the best passing center in the NBA, actually.
Yeah, he definitely has that kind of offensive game. I remember talking with Adam Mutters about it, and he mentioned that Jokic has one of the best handles on the Nuggets as well. And we didn't see a lot of that in the Olympics, but he's just a talented offensive player, and I don't think he'll ever be that defensive linchpin, and that is something to deal with and something to consider, considering his best position is at the five, because his offensive gifts at center are unbelievable. And I'm sure they'll dance with playing him a power forward for stretches just because the defensive part of it is there. But I love Jokic.
Wait, you think he'll be good on defense at power forward?
No. I'm saying that they'll have to do it because they'll want to have a traditional five. I'm not saying he'll be good at it.
Okay. All right.
Basically, I got you. Yeah, he'll be okay. I think he'll be okay offensively there. If you could do some fun stuff with him at the four.
Sure.
You lose some of the tactical advantages, but you could do that. But he's so gifted offensively and in a different way than the guys like Okafor and Vucevic.
Yeah, because he can at least space the floor and pass. Like you're right. He's not taking anything off the table.
And I think he could be kind of the new age offensive five in that way. And the fact that he's such a good passer just adds so much to that.
The defense did not look good for him, I don't think. His defensive rebounding did not look good either. And a lot of, you're always going to look bad against the U.S., but I didn't really see a ton from him either. He has a very good hands defensively. He'll get his hands on some passes, good at reaching in, although how much you want your big center reaching in and picking up foul calls, you have to argue. The Church of Hazonia, how is that doing? Are you picking up members? Are people tithing? Like, what's going on there?
I think that he's just kind of staying about where he was. He didn't have many flashes in the Olympics, but Hazonia's still an incredibly talented player. I wish that he applied his athleticism a little bit more often, especially in transition, but that wasn't really what Croatia did in that sense.
We can learn how to do that from his new teammate, Jeff Green.
I was thinking he could learn how to do it from his current teammate, Aaron Gordon, who's doing a little bit better at that now than he was before. But Hazonia, I think I'm becoming happier with watching him with the ball in his hands. It's not something he should do all the time, but to basically have that for certain stretches is a good thing. And, Croatia had some weird point guard stuff going on, so every once in a while it was in there. I still love his jump shot, and when he tries a little bit defensively, he's capable there. But the challenge, especially as somebody who really likes Hazonia, is that he almost definitely will be, at his best, a smaller piece in a bigger machine. The parallel, the guy that I've compared him to for, I think, 4 years now is J.R. Smith. And I think that's what he's going to need to eventually be. And that might be hard.
Yeah, he's nowhere near as good at getting a shot off the dribble.
Right, but just the idea of being like the third or fourth option. And then when you apply yourself defensively, like that's more of what he is than somebody bigger than that. Like somebody maybe like more what Nikola Batum has become for the Hornets. Like, I don't think he's going to probably be that guy, but I don't write off somebody when they're 21.
Yeah, I passed the collection plate while I was attending services without putting anything in it at the Church of Hazonia.
Harsh.
Some quicker hitters, guys who didn't play a ton. Willie Hernan Gomez, I felt like my description of him as sort of an Enes Kanter who plays smarter and might actually be a little bit less athletic. Would you agree kind of with that assessment of him?
I don't think he has the offensive versatility that Kanter does.
Yeah, he's not a beast on the offensive glass quite the way Kanter is, but he's smarter. I think he can get to being a better defensive player, but slow afoot. We haven't seen much of a jumper from him yet. It'd be interesting to see kind of how he works. I think he can be a good passer, sort of smart, skilled big man, but that player, if you're not shooting threes, if you're not really able to score in the post, he's okay in the pick and roll. He has a knack for finding good spaces in the pick and roll, and he's coordinated, can catch on the move and finish okay. Maybe he can be a backup big man. I don't really expect him to contribute a ton in New York this year. What about Sabonis? What do you think of him?
I thought he was a non-factor most of the time when I watched, and that's not a huge criticism considering he wasn't, that just really wasn't the role that he was in most of the time. But I go back to my prior stuff, which is that I like him, but I don't love him in the NBA.
He looked comfortable shooting his jumper from the mid-range. I think he took one three that he didn't make. He was entrusted to switch out on the perimeter a little bit more. He looked okay doing that in this setting. I don't know whether we're going to see him do that successfully in the NBA. And then he plays really hard. He gets on the glass. His finishing is going to be a major problem because he is so left-hand dominant. And he combines that with not really being big enough or strong enough to knock guys back Zach Randolph style and not having a ton of length and not having a ton of explosion. So if he can't get it together with his right hand, and guys would be sitting all over that left within 2-3 weeks in the NBA, I think he could really struggle to finish inside. I gotta be honest, I never have really seen it with him as far as how high he was picked. I think he plays hard. I think maybe he could eventually be a rotation big. I think it'll be very difficult for him to become a starter unless he really becomes a knockdown three-point shooter. And I don't know, you know, we've seen plenty of guys who are 20 years old and don't really shoot it that well get there. He shoots okay from the free throw line, but he's got a long way to go to me. Cristiano Felicio, kind of a disappointing tournament, ended up kind of even getting out of the rotation for Brazil. He got replaced by Augusto Lima, who I saw a few years ago at the Euro camp. He's a good NBA power forward size guy. He's got an okay mid-ranger, not great. It likes to run in off of 1 foot and go for tip dunks. I thought he provided some nice energy. Not sure he's an NBA guy, but maybe someone who deserves a look at some point.
It was intriguing. I didn't realize, I think he's 24. I thought he was older than that, which is a good sign with somebody playing in that kind of a setting.
Luka Bobic, and
you really liked Luka Bobic.
Well, I liked what he did in this tournament. And then Darko Planinic, both guys who I loved, and I asked KP what their translations looked like, and the answer was very, very bad. So I don't see either of those guys ever contributing in the NBA, but I mean Bobic, 6'8", was able to bring the ball up court hard, dribble, hit three pointers at a decent rate, showed some versatility defensively. But you know, again, you don't want to overreact to a tournament, and Planinic plays real hard. Love the way he fights on the offensive glass and seals guys for deep post-ups. But again, he KP said he graded out as one of the worst players in the ACB league as far as NBA translation. So I won't expect to be seeing him in an NBA uniform anytime soon. We didn't see Alex Abrines at all. We talked a little bit about Teodosic for the NBA already. Bogdan Bogdanovic, how about him?
I was completely flummoxed to why he wasn't starting more often, especially against the U.S., because that would have taken away a spot for Kyrie to hide.
Yeah, he started early in the tournament, and they took off defensively when they went with Kalinic and Makvan. They went with Makvan, I think, because they wanted to guard Saric, and that worked out pretty well in the quarterfinals. So I understood why they did that. Bogdanovic, not really a great defensive player, and had some rough shooting nights. I think he can go off at times, but and can get to the basket off of 1 foot at times in a European setting. I don't think he's really going to be effective finishing at the rim in the NBA. I think of him as, you know, maybe he could come in and be a backup shooting guard for you. I think of him as sort of a Marco Bellinelli with like less ball skills and maybe, you know, probably even not as athletic. I think Marco was more athletic back when he was younger. So I don't think of him as some great prospect. Maybe he'll come over. I don't expect him to have a major impact in the league, though, unless he really, you know, I mean, he looks kind of like, you know, a 36% three-point shooter in the NBA, not like a 40% guy.
I think that he is a lot better suited to that kind of a backup role just because the twos and theoretically threes that will be guarding him won't be those same type of guys, because I think if you put a lot of the NBA starting caliber twos and threes on him, he just won't be able to get quality looks.
Patricio Guerrero, who signed on with the Spurs per Woj, two whole tweets for that signing by Woj. I wonder who Guerrero's agent is, but he actually looked okay, more athletic than some of the other Argentine guys, we could say at least, and shot standstill threes all right. And, you know, maybe they could make something out of him in San Antonio. I don't think that he had particularly impressive stats coming out of college, but we'll see. And then, yeah, I think that's it for these NBA prospects. We will be back momentarily with a continuation of our best and worst contracts since the lockout. First, though, I want to tell you about the Ring Video doorbell. I live in this townhouse, and just due to the way it's structured, our front door is down like 3 flights of stairs, basically, from my bedroom. And when a package comes or something, the door will ring, and then they'll just leave. And I have to waste time by going down there just to find out there's a package I could have gotten at any time. It takes me like a minute to get down there if I'm doing something else. The Ring Video doorbell eliminates that for me because there's a small camera that you can just attach to the side of your home. And then it'll send a picture of anyone who comes to your door to your smartphone, no matter where you are. You don't have to be at home. Even you can be thousands of miles away in the living room, whatever. There are also great security implications for this because a lot of burglaries happen in broad daylight with a burglar ringing your doorbell. I travel for business a lot. Either my girlfriend's at home or no one is. It's always good to know who it is who's coming to my door. And with the Ring of Security kit, you can get a stick-up cam that you can install elsewhere on the property as well. You can do it in minutes. You don't have to do any kind of hard wiring or anything the way you would with traditional video systems. And this will provide 24/7 monitoring of your entire home. And it wouldn't be a dunked on ad if you couldn't get a discount. In this case, $50 off that Ring of Security kit. It's the lowest price anywhere. You can go to ring.com/capspace. Easy to remember, capspace. We talk about it all the time on the show. It's a URL, ring.com/capspace for $50 off that Ring of Security kit, ring.com/capspace. So we finish up with 2013. Do you want to start us off here in 2014? For those who didn't listen to the first part of this, go back and give it a shot. We're basically talking about our best and worst contracts, each selecting a few, and then we're going to run through at the end, pick our best and worst since the lockout, and give out some other little awards here as well. So Danny, why don't you start us off with the 2014 offseason?
So there are kind of a couple families, I like to call it, of best contracts in this. And I think the most traditional, really good contract in this is Kyle Lowry. Lowry was flirting with Miami reportedly and ended up going back to Toronto on a 4-year contract, which was $12 million per year, but that fourth year is a player option, which everyone now expects him to decline. He has become an all-star, Olympian, and so he's done better than that, but it really looks good.
We long lauded Masai Ujiri for acting quickly at the very beginning in 2014. You remember that's when the whole NBA world was paralyzed until LeBron James made his decision to go back to Cleveland, and then you had that crazy flurry. It was like the first couple of days of Summer League, actually. By that time, it had gone almost 7 or 8 days since July 1st, but Ujiri moved quickly. He re-signed Lowry. I remember my tweet at the time was, that's a steal, and it turned out it has been. A Lowry, even when he was playing at that level, you remember that was the year that the Raptors traded away Rudy Gay and then ended up really going on a roll, losing to the Nets in the first round. And Lowry at that point, you know, he had 2 better years than he had in 2014. Even as he got older, you couldn't have necessarily expected that at the time. But even so, with the cap going up, considering like the dearth of point guards on the market these last couple of years, that really was an absolute steal. And now he'll be a free agent when he's 31 at the end of this year. They got really just 3 great years out of him at a discount at a time, just re-signing a veteran free agent when you rarely get that. And they did the same thing with Patrick Patterson as well. Not among the best, but 3 years, $18 million for him as a, you know, lower end starter, high end backup type of player was also an excellent deal by Ujiri as well.
I want to talk about these ones together, but the 2014 offseason was an amazing one in terms of value signings. And so I'm talking on the real, real low end. So Kent Bazemore to the Hawks, Hassan Whiteside to the Heat, Robert
Covington. Yeah, that was in season, though, brought him in, yeah.
Robert Covington for a deal that is still ridiculous for 2 more seasons. Like, all of those, to me, really stand out as being, you know, Whiteside was, of course, had been out of the league, so that's a different kind of a risk, but those are all huge in terms of surplus value, and also, you know, all those players, Covington's still under contract, but the other 2 re-signed with that team despite them not having match rights. So they used that, actually not even having full bird rights.
The Warriors also did well that offseason. Sean Livingston, full mid-level exception for 3 years, with the last year only $3 million guaranteed. Really the first good contract on this list that we saw with that full mid-level exception, although he didn't go the full 4 years. And then Klay Thompson's extension, we've talked about that many times, similar to what CJ McCollum just did. You could say maybe the only mistake by the Warriors was not waiting for him to be a free agent or not even making him their designated player, but because they locked him in for what the max was projected at the time, the cap ended up going up another $4 million in projection. So they saved themselves about $1 million a year in salary and then a bunch of luxury tax this past year as well. And that, a lot of those kind of little moves, Draymond Green, who will get to the next year, help them have the room for Kevin Durant and be able to keep Livingston and as well this offseason.
And then the middle tier are some really good contracts that both ended up on the Celtics. Avery Bradley signed with them originally, 4 years, $32 million. And then Isaiah
People were freaking out at how much Avery Bradley was getting at that time. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
Yeah, and I did an article saying, hey, these enormous contracts are the new reality in the NBA. Well, if Avery Bradley were a free agent right now, he'd get, you know, $16, $17 million a year, probably more than that. I mean, he might get more than Kent Bazemore, actually. So that turned out to be a great deal.
And then the second one of that was Isaiah Thomas, who got signed and traded from the Kings to the Suns, making on a 4 year, $27 million declining contract, which is ridiculous. And then because of all the turmoil in Phoenix, was then traded for a first round pick to Boston and now is on one of the better contracts in the league, non-rookie scale edition.
Ryan McDonough was looking so good in the summer of 2014. He comes in, they unexpectedly win, I think, 48 games that year, barely missed the playoffs after they're supposed to be one of the worst teams. Then he signs Isaiah Thomas to that awesome contract. Eric Bledsoe twisted on the wind for a while. Then the news came down of what the new TV deal was going to be, and they gave him 5 for $70 million as a restricted free agent. And then they also signed Markieff Morris and Marcus Morris to extensions, 4 years, $32 million for Markieff, Marcus 4 for $16 million. Two great contracts. But in signing them to those contracts, they almost actually torpedoed a lot of what the Suns would be in the future, because there was sort of this implicit idea that they were going to get to stick together. They offered them a certain amount of money and basically $12 million a year and allowed them to split it between them however they saw best. And now neither of those guys is on the team anymore. They traded away Marcus for nothing. They did get that first rounder for Markieff, which was decent. But I think if Markieff were playing well still, you probably would have rather had him on that contract. So it was interesting that signing him to those deals actually ended up, you could say, hurting the franchise, even though they're a great contract.
Yeah, I think that's a healthy way to think about it. And the other one we have to mention in the positive is Patty Mills, who was coming off that, I believe, was a shoulder injury and ended up signing 3 years, $12 million with Spurs, which is an absolute bargain.
Yeah, Evan Turner, another one too, which, you know, he was traded to Indiana, basically had no offers at that point. He'd been the number two pick in 2010, and Boston did a great job rehabilitating him and then let somebody else pay him 4 years, $70 million. How about on the bad side? What sticks out for you?
I can't start anywhere but Anderson Varejao, because that was one that looked bad the second it was signed. So he signed a 3 year, $30 million extension. And my favorite part of his contract was how the last year was non-guaranteed, but the year before was like 95% guaranteed. It was like this hilarious thing where it was so close to fully guaranteed, but they saved a little bit, and then ended up saving the Portland Trailblazers a little bit of money before they cut him.
Varejao at the time, I want to say, was like 31. He'd played more than 25 games in, I want to say, like one of the past 3 years beforehand. And he wasn't anywhere. It was an extension. He was going to be a free agent the next year, and giving him two more guaranteed years at $10 million a year. I guess they wanted to do it because of LeBron James, but this was just, there was no reason to do this. Nobody put a gun to their head, you would hope. And he wasn't any good at the time. And then he promptly tore his Achilles right after that too. And they ended up basically having to punt a first round pick to get rid of him. But you could argue that giving him this extension won them the 2016 NBA championship.
So now we're getting even more convoluted than trading him won them the championship, that signing him won them the championship. And I'm fully
on. Yeah, because they then had to trade him, and then he got bought out and he ended up on the Warriors. And who knows, maybe he'll even win him the 2017 championship when Steve Kerr decides to play him in the fourth quarter of Game 7 in these finals.
So can we retroactively give LeBron James the 2014-15 Executive of the Year award then?
No, I think that would be reserved for Nick Kupchak or Mitch Kupchak for giving Nick Young a 4-year, $21 million deal at age 29. Not, you know, $5 billion a year, not the end of the world, but still just one of the most inexplicable contracts in NBA history.
That player option is consistently funny to me.
Yeah. Young just was not good the year before. He was not really good at any point in his career prior to that. He was 29 and just immediately was unplayable. And, you know, just they've been trying to deal him from 2 months after this deal was signed.
And we're only probably about a week and a half away from them being able to use the stretch provision in the competent way. And I assume that's what's going to be what happens.
This is another one from the Phoenix Ledger that is just kind of their ugly record of just not effectively dealing with the emotional component with players, because even when they had tried, it didn't work. They signed Zoran Dragic to a 2-year, $4 million contract. Zoran Dragic is not an NBA player. No one thought that he was. They basically were doing this as a sop to Goran Dragic, who could be a free agent. And a mere 4 months later or so, Goran Dragic was telling reporters that he wanted to be traded, and then they dumped into Miami. But as with any Phoenix move, it was double-sided. They were going to lose him probably for nothing as a free agent, and they got two first-round picks out of Miami. Dragic ended up playing basically zero relevant NBA minutes, and then ended up being dumped on Boston and bought out by Miami in their efforts to avoid the tax in 2015.
Yeah, Dragic is another one of those. And Lance Stephenson is hard because I was relatively confident, I think, that
everyone thought that was a good contract.
I thought it was a reasonable contract, but that he wasn't going to work as well in Charlotte. But there is no chance that I thought it was going to be as disastrous as it turned out to be.
Yeah, that was a different Charlotte team with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist on the wing. They were more built around Al Jefferson. They hadn't really gone in the way of embracing the three-pointer a little more. They didn't have
Batum. He helped inspire that.
Yeah. And so really they had no spacing. He had one of the worst shooting seasons in NBA history, and ended up, you know, getting dumped to the Clippers. And now he basically doesn't even have a deal yet for this year. Another one that was just sort of in the inexplicable, but at least not very hurtful realm, was Ben Gordon getting 2 years, $10 million, with the second year non-guaranteed with the Magic. It was pretty clear that he couldn't play anymore.
One third Jeff Green money.
So what were some ones that you were wrong about in this offseason? I actually had four of them that I looked at that I did not have the right read on at the time.
I think for me, the biggest one is Markieff, because I was just so over the moon, and he still could get there. But I was just, oh man, that's like one of the best contracts in the league, and all this and all of the possibilities. And I didn't see the twin thing come into play, though that admittedly was hard to see at the time. And, you know, I guess you could argue, as you did, that it kind of did work out for them in terms of getting a lottery pick. And then I think that was part of the package to get Marquise Chris. But at the time, I was in love with that contract.
Marvin Williams to Charlotte for 2 years, $14 million was one. He had really struggled with his health. He was coming off an Achilles injury in Utah, looked like he just was moving around like an old man out there, and looked about the same in Charlotte, maybe a little bit better last year, but was horrible on defense. And then the year that he had this year was so important to their renaissance as either a starting three or four. He shot the ball well from three, suddenly was protecting the rim, looked really athletic, and he ended up re-signing on what I think could end up being an ugly deal by the end of it, but certainly was well worth that 2 for $14 that Charlotte gave him. Another one that I panned at the time, although it was before I knew that the last year was non-guaranteed, but even if it had been fully guaranteed, it would have been good, was PJ Tucker for 3 years, $15 million. He had kind of emerged as an end of the bench guy, but was already 29, off the end of the bench to be, you know, a fringe starter for Phoenix, defensive presence, leader. And he was 29 at the time, though, and I felt like he just wasn't a good enough shooter. He wasn't going to age well as kind of an undersized, stocky type of guy. And he's just more, even because of the way the market went, than his own skills, is just, you know, a value contract this year. And they would never dream of waiving him with that $1 million guaranteed this year.
Can I go back to the worst? Just, it's not a contract I was wrong on, but I feel feel like it's one that we need to discuss, and it's Carmelo Anthony. And so he, the issue that I had with it, and I wrote this at the time, was the combination of a full max and a no trade clause, because I just saw the writing.
Yeah,
on the
you know ball. What? That's a great point. Like, you don't think of, we always think about the money. We don't think about the no trade.
Like that, it was the combination that was deadly for the Knicks and still is, because it gave him complete control over the situation. He also has that big trade kicker, so that kind of ensured that he was going to be around for at least for a little while. And now, after they got Porzingis, I feel like having him on that contract and that no trade is what led them more specifically down the path that they ended up this year, which I think will end up being disastrous for them. It's not now, but it will be later.
Well, so let's say Carmelo had said, I'm not re-signing without near full max. Well, they did get a little bit of a concession from him in terms of having his salary go down. I think, I can't remember if it was last year or this year. I think this year. So it was a little bit less than the full max that he could have gotten. So it wasn't, they did at least get a little bit there for him. But let's say Carmelo had said, all right, I'm not re-signing unless you give me a no trade clause. You're telling me you would have let him walk if you're Phil Jackson 2 months after you come out of the job?
I would have, but I understand why Phil had different pressures than I would have.
And because you basically would have been consigning yourself to be 16 or 17 and 65 the next year. There's no, mm-hmm. That would have been unacceptable.
Well, I mean, the unwillingness to be 17 and 65 is, I think, part of what has led the Knicks down this road.
Yeah. Well, as it turned out, of course, they were anyway.
And they got Porzingis, so it worked out.
Yeah, and they got Porzingis. It did work out.
Though if they'd gotten Towns, that would have been nice too.
I think that contract's fine. It's just the no trade that's the issue. But would any team that wasn't that much of a contender have really wanted Carmelo anyway?
I'm sure somebody would have. Like, think about New Orleans or somebody.
Yeah,
like
the Kings would have traded for
him. Oh, yeah. So. They could have gotten some assets.
So, two more that I was wrong about. Darren Collison in Sacramento, 3 years for the full MLE, was a contract I didn't think would be good enough. I didn't think he could be their starter. He actually played very well in 14-15 when he was healthy, and it's been an okay backup point guard, and that money is, that contract sure looks good when you consider what Ish Smith or DJ Augustin signed for. He's better than both of those guys. And I thought that he had just been sort of an average backup with the Clippers the year before, had been really struggled in the playoffs as their backup point guard. I didn't think he was worth what was kind of fringe starter, very good backup money, and he turned out to be worth it. And then Papanikolaou in Houston, I thought he would actually be a useful NBA player, but he just never was able to hit a shot. I liked the way he moved the ball and his intensity defending, but he was just so bad on offense that he just could never work out. And his shooting in the EuroLeague had been fluky. He'd had some really good years, some really bad years, and it looked like, you know, especially with the longer NBA line, the bad years ended up predominating.
Oh, and I another one I was wrong on, Tony Parker. I thought, you know, below market, thought that would be a wonderful fit. I didn't think he would age as quickly as he has.
Yeah, I thought that one would be bad. I think from his ages 33 to 35 season, basically 3 years, $45 million, and they re-signed him a year early. I think maybe they felt like they needed to do that because he supposedly had been underpaid, but he never really took less than market value at the particular time that he had signed his contracts. It just turned out that he aged incredibly well over the previous contract, and now predictably he's kind of fallen off a little bit, and I think this year he is not really even going to be a starting caliber of player.
Are you ready to move on to 2015?
Yeah, I had two here, and there are a ton of great contracts in that 2015 offseason because we even talked about it at the time. Everyone knew the cap rise was coming, but teams were just artificially constrained in what they could pay guys. But the one that I think we're going to be looking at for a long, long time as the best of this group is Jay Crowder, 5 years, $35 million as a restricted free agent with the Celtics. I mean, especially the 5 years, that is fantastic. And he's a guy who's one of the best 3-and-D guys in the East, and he's got four more years now on that contract at $7 million per.
Yeah, that was one of them that was really shocking. I remember when we were dealing with the
shocking
mock-ups.
In that you thought it was so much more than he would get?
No, I thought he was worth a lot more than he got.
Oh, okay.
And
well, remember, I mean, if you think about it, he had barely played until that year in Dallas, was just playing as a guy off the bench, and ended up still wasn't even necessarily, you know, Evan Turner was getting more time than him even going into those playoffs. And then he had that sprained ACL that he suffered when J.R. Smith cheap shotted him in that series against the Cavs. So I think this was something that surprised a lot of people. I thought it was a great risk at the time. I gave him a very high grade in the offseason, in part because of that contract. So I thought it was pretty good, and but it's turned out to be even better because he had a wonderful year last year. We'll see what happens to his three-point shooting, though. You know, maybe if his three-point shooting goes down to being 33%, then, you know, it doesn't look as good. But he's still a quality starter. He can switch. He is great on the boards for his position, gets a ton of steals, and while not an absolute lockdown guy, a very, very solid defender as part of a great Celtics perimeter defense in general.
So two, I want to start with two that I kind of think about differently a little bit now. So Danny Green with the Spurs, that was the deal that people talk about how Kawhi helped facilitate LaMarcus Aldridge coming. Danny Green did so similarly and took a lot less money than I thought he
could get. No, he didn't. That had nothing to do with it. This is why I was shocked that he took so little, because remember, his cap hold was on the books at like $6 million or something.
Right, but
so they could have paid him. They could have paid him whatever they want.
They had full birds. You're right.
Yeah, they signed him after Aldridge already came. That's why this was such a steal, is because
that's right,
and especially because he had offers out there, I think, from the Pistons that, you know, that would have been a lot more than that. And I guess he just maybe was told, all right, you're going to take less here, but, and, you know, that's going to help. That probably helped them sign Pau Gasol this year, for example, and they're going to have up to $30 million in room next year, depending on what happens, and he'll certainly help them in that respect. But for that 1 year, it didn't matter what they paid him, and that's what made this such a steal, because they had full bird rights, and they, you know, he didn't demand that they use him to pay him market rate.
And the one that I didn't love as much at the time, but has gotten more impressive, is the first signing on that July 1st, which is Al-Farouq Aminu. 4 years, $30 million, looks incredible now.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that it really was the first signing. We talked about it when we recorded that night at, you know, 2 a.m. or whatever, and people were shocked because he had played for the minimum the previous year with the Mavericks. He has also taken his game to another level with his three-point shooting becoming kind of average. He's definitely very streaky, but he'll hit enough to keep the defense honest at times, and that allows him to play on the wing where his defense is more useful. I thought that he and Harkless together, with those guys both being able to guard either threes or fours, really in a lot of cases 1 through 4, made them very formidable. And I think he's a guy who's going to be a fixture on the wing for them for a long time at what is probably, you know, if he were on the market this year, he would have gotten $15 million a year.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I was shocked at the time with Patrick Beverley. I thought he was going to get a lot more. The maybe what offended me about that contract was how his final year was non-guaranteed. So we got 4 years, $25 million. It's like, okay, you're already getting your guy for nothing, and then you get the last year non-guaranteed just because you can.
Draymond Green is another one that somehow he managed to not get the max over 5 years. 5 years, $82 million. He has said that he deliberately took less, and again, this is another one where they enabled him to fit in Kevin Durant. So when you get Kevin Durant the next year, the whole "hey, I took less" thing kind of sounds a little bit better.
We have to mention Will Barton.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with him this year too. But 3 years, there's so many guys.
That's a really good contract. Omri Caspi, 2 years, $6 million. One of my favorite contracts that summer.
One that I was wrong about was Corey Joseph. I felt like he just wasn't a good enough offensive player, and what he was able to do, especially playing alongside Lowry and their bench units, was really fantastic last year for the Raptors at 4 years, $30 million. And the Amir Johnson, Jonas Jerebko non-guarantees, they ended up not using those non-guarantees, but those were great contracts for guys who were in their front court rotation. $12 million for Johnson, $5 million for Jerebko, and then non-guaranteed for both of those second years. The two guys who signed for like $2 million a year, Jeremy Lin for the BAE, I actually got that right, I've been calling it the room exception way too much, with the Hornets, and then Bismack Biyombo for the room exception with the Raptors. Both of those were steals at the time. We were saying it at the time, and both those guys obviously got paid this summer, so it worked out for them, and their teams both played very well with them in the lineup.
The other really fruitful value bargain basement one was Ish Smith, signed right before the season started with the Pelicans, played a role in kind of handling that team as they dealt with their injury abyss. And then the Pelicans got two solid second round picks for him.
Yeah, I mean, there really are a billion of these. Chris Middleton was another one. Ed Davis. But I think from a cap management standpoint, Wilson Chandler and Danilo Gallinari, those renegotiations and extensions, those really paved the way for some of the deals that we saw this year. James Harden, Russell Westbrook were teams that had cap space and didn't know what to do with it, thought that, all right, we can bump guys up and get them to sign an extension. It was the way finally for teams to sign guys to extensions that were market rate that I would actually want to sign, because there's the limitation on signing extensions normally that can only be 107.5% of your previous year's salary. And for guys who weren't making that much with the cap going up, it didn't appeal. So you had to bump them first with the renegotiation and then extend them. They did that with Chandler and Gallo. And I think while those teams may have thought of it, both Oklahoma City and Houston, for example, are pretty cap savvy organizations on their own. Denver was the first to do it. Let's get into the worst column. You really had to try hard to sign a bad contract in this offseason, but quite a few teams still succeeded.
Congratulations, New Orleans. You definitely succeeded.
Oshik is one of the worst contracts. I mean, very clearly to me, the worst contract that was signed in 2015.
Yeah, 4 years, $41 million, and then a partially guaranteed fifth season. Just horrendous for them for so many reasons. He was, you know, outmoded at that time, injury prone, already looking like he was going to be on the backside of his career. And Anthony Davis is probably better. I mean, I think you want to bounce him between the two big man positions, but committing that kind of money in Oshik and also in Alexei Ajinsa at true center took away a lot of their flexibility, and those players weren't good enough to justify that sacrifice.
Yeah, they had traded a first rounder to get him that eventually became Sam Decker from the Rockets the previous offseason, and of course they felt with that sunk cost that they had to re-sign him, and he at 29 already when they signed him, just not a good offensive player. Maybe he'll play better this year because he did struggle with injuries, but he struggled with injuries basically throughout his entire career, even before he was in the NBA. It's not like they defended so amazingly when he played there in 2015, and he wasn't able to stay on the floor in the slightest against the Warriors in that playoff series in 2015. So the writing was on the wall that they just needed to do better, but they felt like they wanted to just use their bird rights to retain all these guys. Dante Cunningham was another one of those, Alexis Ajinsa, all those guys fall in that category. Ajinsa, I think, was 4 years 16 or 4 years 20, and then Cunningham was, they used part of their full MLE on him because they didn't have bird rights, 3 years, $9 million for him. Who else sticks out to you as being really bad from that summer of 2015?
JJ Barea, which is the whole DeAndre Jordan saga. That was a whole unfortunate thing.
I give him a pass on that.
Give him a pass, but it's still a bad contract.
I think Monte Ellis is one really for the Pacers that kind of compromised their defensive identity a little bit. He was supposed to boost the offense. Guess what? They were still 24th in offense last year, even with Paul George coming back. Doesn't defend at all, doesn't shoot threes, couldn't get to the basket without the spacing in the Maverick system. This was one of those ones where they should have known that he was going to be a lot worse leaving Dallas, and you know, they've still got another 3 years left on that contract.
What did you think of the Kyle Singler signing when it happened? I remember the years freaked me out a little bit, but the dollars per year didn't.
Yeah, I thought it was fine, actually. I thought that he had been, if he had played the way that he had played in Detroit last year, he would have totally been worth that contract, but he just suddenly was unable to make a three-pointer or any kind of a shot really as soon as he set foot on Oklahoma soil, and it felt like, okay, that now they had a good chance to buy low on him. He was going to revert back, and he just continued to be terrible last year, and now that's looking like a total sunk cost. So I didn't think that was like some steal, but I thought he could be a rotation player, and at $5 million a year in this environment, that seemed fine. And now it doesn't, at least the last year of that 5 for 25 is not guaranteed.
Speaking of continuing to be terrible, Andrea Bargnani with the Nets, I just thought there was nothing there, and they gave him 2 years. I think that's the part of it that really bothered me.
Yeah, it was the minimum, though. Who cares?
Yeah, and they didn't. It's just, he was just terrible.
Corey Brewer was really bad. That was another one that I hated at the time, and he was one of the worst rotation players in the league last year at, I think, 3 for 23. Just doesn't shoot threes, was getting old, never that great of a defensive player to begin with. CJ Watson in Orlando, I think we both really disliked that one. Are there any ones that you look back on as we were wrong about? I mean, this is only a year hence So
I have I think big ones. Greg Monroe. Papered over the flaws that his flaws.
We talked about this in the grades in the 2015 grade revisions a couple weeks ago. Like, yeah, that we were both wrong on that one. And I mean, at least it was only 3 years.
And it might only
third
be
year
two.
Player option. Yeah. One that I was wrong about was Lou Williams. I thought that would be a pretty good value. I want to say that was 3 years, $21 million with the Lakers off the top of my head.
Yeah, and straight 7 a year.
Yeah, he was coming off a Sixth Man of the Year award. I thought that he might actually help, and just he fell into another one of these defenseless Lakers gunners. I think he could still help a team. I think he would be great on, say, the Pistons, a team that really needs some bench scoring, someone who can be efficient and get some BS foul calls. And we saw that guys who are role players on the 2014-15 Lakers got very much underpaid and turned out to actually be real players because they're playing under Byron Scott with Kobe Bryant and all these rookies and just, you know, a terrible system. He might be someone like that as well if they were able to move him. But I think they aren't going to just dump him. They would want an asset. And I think I would give up a second rounder for him for sure, but I probably wouldn't give up a first. And so now you're in this situation where it's kind of difficult to find the right value for him. I think he's kind of in that dead zone at the moment.
And in a way, having his $7 million on the books hurt them this summer just because it narrowed their options a little bit, though I'm not sure, considering how they spent their money, that would
have helped. They had $60 million in space. I think they had plenty of options.
Yeah.
Did they need to sign another center? Maybe that.
I don't know. They could have signed, maybe that guy'd be better than Mozgov.
2016 we'll just gloss over because I think that it's way too soon to say, and we've also talked about a lot of these, but I think the two that pop out to me is Evan Turner and Timofey Mozgov are the two that I think are just really bad. Actually, I guess there's also Garrett Temple.
Yeah, I was gonna add him.
Because he's just, I mean, that's just one of these. Yeah, it's $8 million a year. That's like, you know, $5 million a year at the beginning of this exercise. Now that the cap is 94, it started off at 58 in 2011. But it's just so inexplicable to think that he can be a decent backup point guard. There's just no chance on that. I feel that was the most inexplicable signing in conjunction with the fact that they let Seth Curry go. They never signed any other point guard at all. I mean, I think it's quite possible that they're going to just have some off the street free agent point guard who's going to be playing backup point guard for them while Garrett Temple kind of wallows at the two inefficiently.
Might even end up starting for them for stretches.
Ryan Anderson, I know, was one of your favorites as well. 4 years, $80 million. Kudos to us though on, when we were talking about the free agent bigs, we sort of scoffed at reports that Ryan Anderson could get $20 million, and then we said, oh, maybe the Rockets or the Kings, and those are the two teams that actually were in a bidding war for him, and the Rockets ended up signing him after they struck out, which is exactly what we said on there, or what we said was we were previewing the free agent big. So we at least deserve credit for that one. I don't think the Rockets are going to deserve credit for signing him, but at least maybe he'll help them this year. You know, at least like you can say that, and then maybe they'll be a really good offense this year. But by the end of that, I think that's going to look pretty ugly. What about good contracts this year? Certainly far fewer of those, I would imagine, than in 2014 and 2015, just due to the cap rising and the sheer amount of money that was out there.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of parallels to 2015 where the best contracts, from what we know now, are the guys who could have gotten maxes who took less. So Batum and Fournier following the Chris Middleton path.
Yeah,
and
then, although, you know, I hate the Batum thing because they didn't start him higher.
Yeah, I'm actually, I got so mad about that over the weekend that I'm actually thinking about writing a piece about it, because I was going through the math and I was like looking at, you know, would they have been in the luxury tax? Where would that be long term? And I just got,
no, and it wouldn't have hurt them at all this
no,
year.
No, like, I got really, belligerently angry about it. And them spending that much, as much as they did on Marvin and all that, they were already going to be out of it for next summer anyway. So they wouldn't have cost themselves anything in terms of that year. So I got really mad. I might end up writing about that. And then of the other, of the more kind of like short term, kind of not like Biombo, but Jeremy Lin and Festus Ezeli, you know, like guys who could end up providing a lot of surplus value, but they might not be long term for their current team.
Another one we actually forgot to throw in 2015 was the MKG extension.
Yes.
That's one that actually...
Even though he missed almost this entire season.
Yeah. Well, it's that contract didn't kick in until right now. So you can judge it over the next 4 years.
That's fair.
But yeah, there really just are not any that you look at this year and you're like, it's either, that guy, I guess that was okay, he's appropriately paid in this new market, or I can't believe they gave him that.
It's going to be Evan Turner. He's going to prove us all wrong.
Yeah. DJ Augustin, another one that I was not... It's the Magic continue to...
That's the other inexplicable. I think that's kind of the parallel of Garrett Temple, whereas Garrett Temple, it's him, and then for DJ Augustine, it's that contract. Like, it's kind of like those are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, the DJ Augustine contract is like, if you build a house with a really ugly first floor that's about to collapse, and then instead of getting a new house, you just build another story on top of that. Like, that's what the CJ Watson and then the DJ Augustin signings are for the Magic.
I feel like we're going to need to build a whole new book of analogies for this Orlando Magic.
All right, this has been going for a while. We'll save our overall observations and awards for the next program, which will probably be coming at some point later this week. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget about our sponsors, ring.com/capspace. You can get $50 off that ring of security kit. And of course, the Naked 3D Fitness Tracker, the world's first home body scanner. Get $50 off that. Lock in that $700 price now. It's going to be $1,000 when it goes on sale in the spring, and you only have to put $95 down. That's naked.fit/capspace. Do you have anything to plug other than your rage about Nicola Batum's contract structure?
My podcast For Real Jam Radio with Derek Bodner came out. I alluded to it last time, but it's actually out now. And then I have a Warriors piece for The Athletic that should be coming out on Monday or Tuesday. And yeah, it's that. And then I'm starting, now that the Olympics are over, I'm going to start working on my really big picture stuff. You know a little bit about it because we've been talking about it. But so that'll start coming out in the next couple weeks, of really looking forward to where all of this is going, because now I think we're kind of past this off season now, and now it's moving towards next off season and the wonderful uncertainty that is the next CBA.
Yeah, we got to start doing some team previews soon. 2017 free agency and cap space preview. Maybe we should do a mailbag soon too. We haven't done one of those in forever.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great way to just have our readers just come up with a topic for a show for us. So as we get into the dog days, maybe that's a good idea. Follow me on Twitter at Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Thanks to everyone who gives us iTunes reviews or ratings. That helps us sell the show to sponsors. And don't forget to patronize those sponsors as well. That's an even better way to support the show. We'll talk to y'all later this week. Till then.